Chapter 32. "This is cheating," said Harrowhark forbiddingly.
"We're just being resourceful," said Palamedes.
They were standing outside a laboratory door that Gideon had never seen. This one had not been hidden, just very inconveniently placed at the topmost accessible point of the tower. It took more stairs than Gideon's knees had ever wanted, and was situated plainly at the end of a terrace corridor where the sun slanted in through broken windows. The terrace in question looked so frankly about to disintegrate that Gideon tried to stay close to the corridor's inside wall, in case most of the floor suddenly decided to fall off the side of Canaan House. This lictoral door was the same as the others had been, gaping obsidian eye sockets in carved obsidian temporal bones, black pillars and no handle, and a fretwork symbol to differentiate it from the other two doors Gideon had seen. This one looked like three rings joined on a line.
"We have no key," Harrow was saying. "This is not entering a locked door with permission."
Palamedes waved a hand.
"I completed this challenge. We have the right to the key. That's basically the same thing."
"That is absolutely not the same thing."
"Look, if we're keeping track, which I am, the key for this room currently belongs to Silas Octokizeron. Lady Septimus had it, and he took it off her. That means the only way either of us ever gets inside is by defeating Colum the Eighth in a fair duel."
"I can take Colum," said Camilla.
"Pretty sure I can also take Colum," added Gideon. "And then relying on Octokizeron to hand it over, which he won't," concluded Palamedes triumphantly. "Reverend Daughter, you know as well as I do that the Eighth House wouldn't let a little thing like fair play get in the way of its sacred duty to do whatever it wants."
Harrow looked conflicted. "This is no ordinary lock. We're not just going to pick it with a bit of bone, Sextus."
"No, of course not. I told you, Lady Septimus let me hold the key.
I'm an adept of the Sixth."
"She might as well have let me make a silicone mould of the damn thing. I can picture every detail of that key right down to the microscopic level. But what am I going to do by myself? Carve a new one out of wood?"
Harrow sighed. Then she rummaged in her pocket and took out a little nodule of bone, which she placed in the palm of her right hand.
"All right," she said. "Describe it for me."
Palamedes stared at her.
"Hurry up," she prompted. "I'm not waiting for the Second to find us."
It looked like a key," he said. "It had a long shaft and some teeth. I can't just describe a molecular structure like it's someone's outfit."
"Then how exactly am I meant to replicate it?" demanded Harrow. "I can't..."
"Oh. No.
You did imaging and response right. You must have. You got the key for it. Same deal. I'm going to think about the key, and you're going to see it through my eyes."
"Sextus," said Harrow darkly.
Wait, put in Gideon, intrigued. "You're going to read his mind?"
"No," said both necromancers immediately. Then Palamedes said, "Well, technically, sort of."
"No," said Harrow. "You remember the construct challenge, Nav. I couldn't read your mind then. It's more like borrowing perceptions." She turned back to Palamedes. "Sextus, this was bad enough when I did it to my own cavalier. You're going to have to focus on that key incredibly hard. If you get distracted..."
"He doesn't get distracted," said Camilla, as if this had caused difficulties in the past.
Palamedes closed his eyes. Harrow gnawed on her lip furiously, then closed hers too. Nothing happened for a good 30 seconds. Gideon was dying to make a joke, just to get a reaction, when the tiny lump of matter in Harrow's palm twitched. It flexed and began to stretch, forming a long, thin cylindrical rod. Another few seconds passed, and a spine of bone extruded slowly from near one end, then another. Gideon was honestly impressed. In all the time Harrow had tormented her back on Dreba,
She had only ever used bones as seeds and starters, stitching them together into tripwires, grasping arms, kicking legs, biting skulls. This was something new. She was using bone like clay, a medium she could shape not just into one of a bunch of predetermined forms, but into something that had never existed before. It looked like it was giving her trouble, too. Her brow was furrowed, and the first faint traces of blood sweat gleamed on her slim throat. "Focus, Sextus," her necromancer gritted out. The object on her palm was now clearly a key. Gideon could see three individual teeth, twisting and flexing as Hero filled in the fine detail. The whole length of the key quivered, and looked for a moment as though it would jump off her hand and fall to the floor. But then it abruptly lay still. Hera opened her eyes, blinked, and peered at it suspiciously. "This won't work," she said. "I've never had to work with something so small before."
"That's what she said," murmured Gideon sotto voce.
Palamedes opened his eyes too, and breathed a long sigh of what sounded like relief.
"It'll be fine," he said unconvincingly. "Come on, let's try it out."
He headed for the black stone door, followed by Harrow, both cavaliers, and the five skeletons that Harrow had refused point blank not to conjure on their way up here. He took the newly formed bone key, examined it, fitted it in the lock, and then turned it decisively to the left. The mechanism went click.
"Oh my God," said Harrow.
Sextus ran a hand convulsively through his hair.
"All right," he said.
"No, I did not actually think that was going to happen. Masterful work, Reverend Daughter."
And he gave her a little mock bow.
"Yes," said Harrow. "Congratulations to you also, Warden."
He pushed the door open onto total blackness. Harrow stepped closer to Gideon and muttered, "If anything moves..."
"Yes, I know. Let it head for Camilla."
Gideon did not know how to handle this new, overprotective Harrowhark, this girl with the hunted expression. She kept looking at Gideon with the screwed-up eyes of someone who had been handed an egg for safekeeping and was surrounded by egg-hunting snakes. But now she stepped forward grandly, spread her palms wide in the necromantic gesture as threatening as a cavalier unsheathing a sword, and strode into the dark. Palamedes went after her, groped around on the wall for a few moments, and then hit the light switch. Gideon stood in the laboratory and stared as Camilla carefully closed the door behind them. This Slichtrol lab was an open-plan bomb wreck. There were three long lab tables covered in old, disused tools, splotches of what looked to be russet fungus, abandoned beakers and used-up pens. The floor underfoot was hairy carpet, and in one corner there was a hideous, slithery tangle of what Gideon realised must be sleeping bags. In another corner, an ancient chin-up bar sagged in the middle alongside a strip of towel left to hang for a myriad. Everywhere there were bits of paper or shaken-out clothes, as though somebody had left the place in a hurry or had simply been an unbelievable slob. Spotlights shone down hot on the ruined jumble.
Said Camilla neutrally, and Gideon knew immediately that she organised Palamedes's and her socks by colour and genre.
Harrowhark and Palamedes picked their way through the mess to the tables. Palamedes was saying in his explanation voice, "It's not as though I didn't complete this challenge by lunchtime, though I had a distinct advantage. It was a psychometrical challenge. The main difficulty was working out what the challenge wanted in the first place. It was set up by someone with an obscure sense of humour. It was just a room with a table, a locked box, and a single molar."
"Reconstruction?"
"Not all of us can respring a body by dint of a molar, Reverend Daughter. Anyway, I must have examined that tooth for 2 hours. I know every single thing there is to know about that tooth. Mandibular second, deciduous eruption,
vitamin deficiency, male, died in his 60s, flossed obediently, never left the planet, died in this selfsame tower. Both of them were riffling through the papers left on the desk. Palamedes left them in forensically exact piles, divided by where they had been found. He adjusted his glasses and said, "Then Camilla took over because I wasn't bloody thinking." Camilla grunted. She had meandered over to look at the rust-pitted crossbars of the chin-up, and Gideon had repaired to the worm mound of sleeping bags to kick them unhelpfully. Harrow said impatiently, "Get to the denouement, Sextus." I had tracked the tooth. It told me nothing. No spiritual links to any part of the building. It was a black hole. It was as though the body it came from had never been alive. No ghost remnants, nothing. This is impossible, you understand. It meant the spirit had somehow been removed entirely. So I did some old-fashioned detective work. He peered under an abandoned clear file. I looked upstairs for the skeleton with the missing upper molar. He wouldn't come down with me, but he did let me make a plaster impression of his clavicle. The clavicle! Someone was having a joke. Anyway, you can imagine my reaction when I unlocked the box with it and found it empty. Gideon looked up from a pasteboard box she had found. It was full of the ring tabs you got on pressurized drink cans and jingled unmusically when she shook it. The constructs? Like the bone servants? Second's right, first isn't, said Camilla laconically. They're the opposite of what Lady Septimus calls the beguiling corpse, said Palamedes. They seem to have most of their faculties intact. Mine was very nice, though he's forgotten how to write. The skeletons aren't reanimations, Ninth. They're revenants. Ghosts inhabiting a physical shell. They simply lack a true revenant's ability to move itself along a thanagetic link. The beguiling corpse is a remnant of spirit attached to a perfect and incorruptible body. That's the idea, anyway. Where what I'll term the hideous corpse is a fully intact spirit attached permanently to a rotting body. Not that someone hasn't preserved those bones beautifully. Harrowhark slammed a ringbinder down on the bench. I'm a fool, she said bitterly. I knew they moved too well to be constructs, no matter how I tried to mimic how they'd been done. I just could have sworn, but that's impossible. They'd need someone to control them. They do, themselves, said Palamedes. They are autonomously powering themselves. It debunks every piece of thanagy theory I ever learned. The old fogies back home would peel their feet for half an hour alone with one. It still doesn't explain why there's no energy signature on the bones, though. Anyway, this is the laboratory of the lictor who created them. And here's their theory. Much like the one back in the other laboratory, the theorem was carved into a big stone slab pinned down in a dusty back corner and covered up with loosely flimsy. Both cavaliers drifted over, and they all together stared at the carved diagrams. The laboratory was very quiet, and the spotlights haloed streams of dust so thick you could lick them. Resting on the edge of the stone set into the table, there was a tooth. Palamedes picked it up. It was a premolar, with long and horrible roots. It was brown with age. He handed it to Harrow, who gently unfolded it in the way that only a bone magician could, and in the way that always made Gideon's jaw hurt. She turned it into a long ribbon of enamel, an orange with the skin taken off and flattened, a three-dimensional object turned two-dimensional. Written on the tooth in tiny, tiny letters was this. 500 into 50. It is finished. Harrowhark took out her fat black journal and was scribbling down notes, but Palamedes had abruptly lost interest in the theory stone. He was looking at the walls instead, flipping open some of the ring binders that she had discarded. He stopped in front of a faded pinboard, riddled thick with pins, all with bits of string attached.
Gideon came to stand next to him.
"Look at this," he said.
There were rainbow splotches of pins all over the board. There were tiny clusters, and Gideon noticed that at the centre of each cluster there was one white pin. The smallest and most numerous clusters had three pins fixed around one white pin. Some others had five or six. Then there were two other separate whorls of pins, each made up of dozens alone, and then one enormous pin splotch, more than 100 of them in a rainbow of colours, thickly clustered around one in white.
"The problem of necromancy," said Palamedes, "is that the acts themselves, if understood, aren't difficult to do. But maintaining anything, we're glass cannons. Our military survives because we have hundreds of thousands of heavily armed men and women with big swords."
"There's always more energy to feed from, Sextus," said Harrow distantly, flicking her eyes back and forth as she copied. "Give me a single death and I can go for 10 minutes.
"Yes, well, that's the problem, isn't it? 10 minutes, then you need more. Thanagy's transient. A necromancer's biggest threat is honestly themselves. My whole house for a reliable food source."
"Warden," said Camilla quite suddenly. She had opened up a ring binder untidy with pages. Inside were an array of old flimsy lithographs, the black and white kind. On the very first page, there was a faded note that had once been yellow, the letters still legible in a short, curt hand.
"Confirmed, independently highlighted. Best option. Ask EJG. Yours, Anastasia. P.S. Give me back my calipers. I need them."
Camilla flipped through the binder. The pictures were hasty, low-quality snaps of men and women from the shoulders up, squinting at the camera, eyes half shut as though they hated the light. Most of them looked very serious and solemn, as though posing for a mugshot. Some of these men and women had been crossed out. Some had a few ticks against their picture. Camilla thumbed a page over, and they all paused. The overexposure did not disguise a head and shoulders photo of the man they all called Teacher. Bright blue eyes, a desaturated sepia, still smiling from a lifetime away. He looked not a day older or younger, and his photograph had been ringed around in a black marker pen.
"Sextus," Harrow began ominously.
"I couldn't tell," said Palamedes.
For his part, he sounded almost dazed.
"Ninth. I absolutely could not tell. Another beguiling corpse."
"Then who's controlling him? There's nobody here but us, Sextus."
"I'd like to hope so. Could he be independent? But how?"
Palamedes' eyes drifted back to the pinboard. He took his spectacles off and squinted his lambent grey eyes at it. He was counting under his breath. Gideon followed along with him gamely up into the hundreds until a dreadful noise startled them out of any mental arithmetic. It was an electronic klaxon from somewhere within the room, and without, it howled, "Brop! Brop! Brop!" This was followed by, bafflingly, a woman's voice, unreasonably calm.
"This is a fire alarm. Please make your way to designated safe zones, led by your fire warden."
Then the klaxon again. "Brop! Brop! Brop!" And the exact same recorded inflection.
"This is a fire alarm. Please make your way."
They looked at each other. Then all four of them sprinted for the door. Palamedes didn't even stop to shut it behind them. The sixth and the ninth houses knew that a fire was absolutely no joke and moved like people who had learned that a fire alarm could be the last thing any of them heard, the last thing their whole house heard. But this was curious. There was no smoke to smell, nor any latent heat. When they all got to the atrium, the only thing they saw amiss was that one of the skeletons had fallen over with an armful of towels, spread eagle in the awful dried-up fountain. Camilla looked around,
narrowed her eyes and headed toward the lunchroom. Here there was an ongoing pshht sound that Gideon could not identify until they reached the kitchen. There was a bad smell and white steam, and realized it was a water sprinkler. The really old kind. They all squashed themselves through the kitchen door and stood out of the reach of the spray. All the skeletons were gone. In their places were untidy piles of bones and sashes. A pan of fish smoked on a lit stove. Gideon waded in, kicked aside a humerus, and fumbled with the knobs until the fire extinguished. There were piles of bones at the sink, a skull floating in a familiar pot of green soup. The tap had been left on, and the sink was close to overflowing. A pile of bones had mixed in among the potato peelings. Gideon ducked back out and away from the spray and stared. She was only vaguely aware of Herohark disdainfully mopping her wet head with a handkerchief. The sprinklers stopped. Camilla knelt down and, amidst all the dripping and burbling, touched one of the phalanges that had fallen on the tiles. It dissolved into ash like a sigh. Palamedes went and turned off the tap like someone in a dream. The bones in the sink gently bobbed against a saucepan. He and Harrow looked at each other and said, "Shit!" With only the faintest liquid whisper of metal on sheath, Camilla drew her swords. Gideon had never had the opportunity to study Camilla's two short swords before. They were more like very long daggers, slightly curved at each end, wholly utilitarian. They glittered clean and hot beneath the soggy light of the kitchen. She marched back toward the door to the dining hall.
"Split up," she said.
"Hell no," said Gideon. Harrow said, "Let's not waste time. Get to Septimus." And Gideon could have kissed her. There seemed to be nobody else in the long, echoing halls of Canaan House, now longer and more echoey than ever. They passed another skeleton, arrested by an unseen force in the middle of carrying a basket. As it tumbled to the floor, the weight of the basket had crushed its brittle pelvis to a powder. When they got to Dulcinea's sick room, Gideon had a sharp moment of not knowing what the hell to expect. But they found Dulcinea struggling feebly to try to sit up, whey-faced and wide-eyed. Opposite her was the salt and pepper priest in the high-backed chair, looking as though they were peacefully asleep.
"It wasn't me," Dulcinea wheezed in no small alarm.
Camilla ducked forward. The white-robed priest's chin had slumped forward to their chest, and the braid was tucked beneath their chin. As Camilla pressed her hand to their neck, the priest lurched very gently sideways, limp and heavy, until the sixth cavalier had to prop them up so that they wouldn't slide off the chair entirely.
"Dead as space," said Herohark, "though, accurately, that's been true for a very, very long time."
Palamedes turned to Dulcinea, who had given up thrashing her way to her elbows and was lying flat on the pillows, panting in exertion. He brushed her hair gently away from her forehead and said,
"Where's teacher?"
"He left me maybe an hour ago," said Dulcinea helplessly, eyes darting between him and the rest of them. "He said he wanted to lock a door. What's going on? Why is the priest dead? Where did teacher go?"
Palamedes patted her hand.
"No idea. This is the interesting part."
"Dulcinea," said Gideon, "are you going to be okay by yourself?" Dulcinea grinned. Her tongue was scarlet with blood. The veins in her eyelids were so dark and prominent that the blue of her eyes appeared a limpid, moonless purple.
"What can anyone do to me now?" she said simply.
They could not even warn her not to let anyone in. She seemed exhausted simply from the act of sitting up. They left her with only the dead priest for company and headed to a wing where Gideon had never gone, the hot, sultry corridor lined with fibrous green plants of all sorts, the wing where the priests and teacher lived. It was a pretty whitewashed passageway, totally out of kilter with the rest of Canaan House. The light bounced off the walls from the clean, well-kept windows.
There was no need to knock at the doors or yell to find the action. At the end of the corridor, there was an absolute pile-up of bones, sashes, and the laid-out body of the other wizened priest. He had collapsed flat on his face with his arms outstretched, as if he had tripped while running. The bones were all piled up outside a closed door, as though they had been trying to get through it. Palamedes led the way, crunching through the wreckage. Gideon put her hand on the hilt of her sword, and Palamedes threw open the door. Inside, Captain Deuteros looked up somewhat wearily. She was sitting in a chair facing the door. Her left arm hung uselessly at her side, wizened and crumpled. Gideon did not want to look at it. It looked like it had been put in a bog for 1,000 years and then stuck back on. Her right arm was tucked up against her stomach. There was an enormous crimson stain spreading out onto the perfect white of her jacket, and her right hand was clasped, as though ready to draw, around the enormous bone shard shoved deep in her gut. Teacher lay unmoving by her side. There was a rapier buried in his chest and a dagger through his neck. There was no blood around the blades, only great splashes of it at his sleeves and his girdle. Gideon looked around for the lieutenant, found her, and then looked away again. She didn't need a very long look to tell that Dias was dead. For one thing, her skeleton and her body had apparently tried to divorce. "He wouldn't listen to reason," said Judith Deuteros in measured tones. "He became aggressive when I attempted to restrain him. Binding spells proved useless. Marta used disabling force. He was the one to escalate the situation. He blew out her eye, so I was compelled to respond. It didn't have to happen." Two professional cohort soldiers, one a necromancer, one a cavalier primary. All this mess for one unearthly old man. Palamedes dropped to his knees beside the captain, but she pushed him away roughly with the tip of her boot. "Do something for her," she said. "Captain," said Camilla, "Lieutenant Dias is dead."
"Then don't touch me. We did what we came to do."
Gideon's eyes were drawn to a machine in the corner. She hadn't noticed it because it seemed ridiculously normal, but it wasn't normal at all, not for Kanan House. It was an electric transmitter box with headphones and a mic. The antenna was set out the window, glowing faint and blue in the afternoon sunshine.
"Captain," said Palamedes, "what did you come to do?"
The second necromancer shifted, grunted in pain, closed her eyes. She sucked in a breath, and a bead of sweat travelled down her temple.
"Save our lives," she said. "I sent an SOS. Backup's coming, Warden. It's just up to you to make sure nobody else dies. He said I'd betrayed the Emperor, said I'd put the Emperor at risk. I entered the Emperor's service when I was 6.
Captain Deuteros's chin was drooping. She lifted it back up with some effort.
"He wasn't human," she said. "He wasn't like anything I'd ever seen before. Marta put him down. Marta, go tell them she avenged the 5th and the 4th.
Palamedes had ignored the kick and moved in again. The second laid one booted foot on his shoulder in warning. He said,
"Captain, you are no use to anyone dead." "It is my privilege to no longer be of use," said the captain. "We fixed the problem none of the rest of you could. Did what we had to do, and paid for it. Dearly."
Harrow had gone to stand over the quiet, punctured corpse of Teacher. She dropped to his side like a long-tailed crow. All Gideon could do was press herself back up against the wall, smell the blood and feel absurdly empty. Her necromancer said,
"You fixed nothing."
"Harrow,"
Palamedes said warningly.
"This man was a shell filled with 100 souls, said Harrow.
The captain's eyes flicked open and stayed open.
"He was a thing of ridiculous power, but he was a prototype.
I doubt he had killed anyone before today. I would be astonished if he had a hand in the deaths of the fourth and fifth houses, as he was created for the sole purpose of safeguarding the place. There is something a great deal more dangerous than an old experiment loose in the first house, and he could have helped us find out what it is. But now you're going to die too, and you'll never know the whole story. The whites of Judith's eyes were very white, her carefully merciless face suddenly a picture of hesitation. Her gaze moved, more remorselessly than Gideon's ever could have, to her cavalier. Then she returned it to them, half furious, half beseeching. Palamedes moved in.
I can't save you, he said. I can't even make you comfortable. A team of trained medics could do both. How far away is the second? How long do we have to wait for cohort backup?
The second's not coming, said Captain Deuteros. She smiled, tight and bitter. There's no communication with the rest of the system, she said, hoarsely now. He didn't lie. There was no way to reach the houses. I got through to the Imperial flagship, Sixth. The Emperor is coming. The King Undying.
Next to Harrow, Teacher gurgled.
You draw him back to the place he must not return to, said the dead man,
with a thin and reedy whistle of a voice around the blade in his vocal cords. His whole body wriggled. His dead eyes no longer twinkled drunkenly, but his tongue slithered. His spine arched.
Oh, Lord, 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 one of them has come back.
His voice trailed off. His body collapsed to the floor. The silence in the wake of his settling was huge and loathsome. Palamedes said,
Judith, give me her sword, she said.
The rapier was too heavy for her to hold. Camilla laid it over the necromancer's knees, and Judith's fingers closed around it. The steel of the hilt was bright in her hand. She squeezed down until her knuckles were white.
At least let us get you out of here, said Gideon, who thought it was a shitty room to die in. No, she said. If he comes back to life again, I will be ready. And I won't leave her now. Nobody should ever have to watch their cavalier die.
The last Gideon ever saw of Captain Judith Deuteros was her propped up on the armchair, sitting as straight as she could possibly manage, bleeding out through the terrible wound at her gut. They left her with her head held high, and her face had no expression at all.